on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News, reporting via remote. I'm Jeff Custer. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Thursday Russian forces occupy about 20% of Ukrainian territory as the war approaches its 100th day on Friday and fighting continues on several fronts. Speaking to the Luxembourg Parliament in a virtual speech Thursday, Zelensky asked the lawmakers to just imagine constant fighting, which stretches along the front line for more than 1,000 kilometers. He said the Ukrainian area controlled by Moscow's forces is comparable to the size of the Netherlands. Zelensky did not say how much territory Russia had captured since the start of its invasion February 24th. Moscow seized Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula in 2014, and Russian-backed separatists had also captured parts of the eastern Donbas region, where fighting is now the most intense. Meanwhile, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg told reporters in Washington Thursday the support the United States and NATO allies are providing Ukraine is making a difference every day on the battlefield, but he does not expect a quick end to the conflict. Stoltenberg spoke to reporters outside the White House following a meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. The NATO chief would make no predictions about how long he expected the Ukrainian conflict to last.
Wars are by nature unpredictable, and therefore we just have to be prepared for the long haul, because what we see is that this war has now become a war of attrition, where the Ukrainians are paying a high price for defending their own country on the battlefield.
Stoltenberg said NATO and NATO allies have deployed troops in the eastern part of Europe as a deterrence and to prevent escalation of the war, not as a provocation. This is VOA News. Police in the central southwest city of Tulsa, Oklahoma, said Thursday a man who blamed his surgeon for ongoing back pain after a recent surgery bought an assault-style rifle hours before opening fire at a Tulsa medical office, killing the surgeon and three other people before fatally shooting himself. Speaking at a news conference, Tulsa Police Chief Wendell Franklin says the gunman, identified as 45-year-old Michael Lewis, had recently undergone back surgery performed by Dr. Preston Phillips and had called the clinic repeatedly complaining of pain. Lewis was in the office Tuesday and received treatment from Dr. Phillips. Lewis also called the clinic again Wednesday before the shooting. The police chief said they found evidence of the gunman's intent.
We have also found a letter on the suspect which made it clear that he came in with the intent to kill Dr. Phillips and anyone who got in his way. He blamed Dr. Phillips for the ongoing pain following the surgery.
Franklin said Lewis shot and killed Phillips Wednesday along with another doctor, a receptionist, and a patient. Britain's Queen Elizabeth joined the working members of her family on the balcony of Buckingham Palace Thursday as British military aircraft roared overhead in honor of her 70 years on the throne. The six-minute display included Typhoon jets flying in formation, spelling out the number 70. Formal celebrations of the Platinum Jubilee began with the Trooping the Colour, an annual military review that has marked the sovereign's official birthday since 1760. The 96-year-old queen is Britain's longest-reigning monarch and the first to reach the milestone of reigning for seven decades on the throne. The event is being celebrated over 4 days throughout Britain and Commonwealth nations throughout the world. Australia, for example, celebrated the Jubilee by lighting a beacon on the Capitol building in Canberra and illuminating landmarks throughout the nation in lights of royal purple. The Australian partner of a journalist who has been detained in China for nearly 2 years said Thursday the journalist is being denied the chance to speak with her family and consular staff, and her health is declining because of a poor prison diet. Journalist Cheng Li, an Australian who was born in China, was detained in August of 2020 on charges of suspicion of sharing state secrets. In March, she was tried in Beijing, but Australian diplomats weren't allowed inside the courtroom. Since the trial, Chinese authorities have deterred announcing the verdict. The 46-year-old Cheng had worked as a business journalist for Chinese state broadcaster China Global Television Network. Speaking about the case publicly for the first time, Cheng's partner Nick Coyle said he was very worried about her health and the lack of access to her family and Australian consular staff. Repeating this hour's top news story, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Thursday Russian forces occupy about 20% of Ukrainian territory. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight. Death on the African continent from COVID-19 are expected to fall 94% in 2022. Tunisian President Kais Saied has fired 27 judges. And tensions remain high between DRC and Rwanda. We'll have these stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. In Equator province in the Western Democratic Republic of Congo, health workers caring for Ebola virus patients have gone on strike. Journalist Jafar Al-Katanti in the DRC city of Goma spoke with VOA's Kate Pond-Dawson about the strike.
Since this morning, they stopped working in the Ebola treatment center. And they went in strike because, according to them, they don't receive their payment, their salary, and their bonus for working in a danger place. And this is a problem because as they stop working, the few number of patients in the Ebola treatment center are themselves, no one to take care about them.
Now, I understand that there's a problem for almost all healthcare workers in getting paid from the government. Can you explain that?
Yes. The government of DRC, since many times, has problem of payment to all state workers, especially doctors and nurses, those who work in the health service. And many times they have to strike in all cities of DRC, and they survive by the payment of patients in their hospitals. But an Ebola treatment center can survive like that because the Ebola treatment is for free.
Now, also, this Ebola outbreak is pretty small. How many patients are there currently, and how many people are being held under observation, roughly?
Just now, they have two patients, confirmed cases. But they also have many people in observation as their contacts. This outbreak is a small one, as that region has already got more than five outbreaks. And since last year, they get vaccination because of another outbreak. So this time, we will not get a large number of patients. And it's a good news.
That was Jafar Al-Katanti in Goma speaking with VOA's Kate Pond-Dawson. The outbreak began in April, and so far the World Health Organization has confirmed fewer than 10 cases. Hundreds of people who were considered close contacts of patients have received Ebola vaccines. Al-Katanti noted, however, there are concerns the outbreak could worsen if the Ebola workers are not available to trace the contacts of infected patients to isolate and vaccinate them. Death on the African continent from COVID-19 are expected to fall 94% in 2022 compared with last year, according to modeling by the World Health Organization. What were the biggest contributors to the change? VOA's Carol Van Dam asked Dr. Amish Ad-Alja, a physician and infectious disease expert at the Johns Hopkins Center for Global Health.
The biggest contributor to the drop in fatalities is the same everywhere in the world, and that has to do with the level of population immunity that has accrued through people being vaccinated in places like Africa where there's lower vaccination rates, people getting infected and developing natural immunity. There are treatments like Paxlovid and monoclonal antibodies, but they may be more or less available in different African countries depending upon where you're looking, but it's largely the level of immunity that the virus is dealing with that's driving fatality rates down.
What about the fact that stats on COVID are less secure in Africa, as reporting facilities are far fewer? There's very few labs doing the COVID testing in Africa on the continent. So how reliable do you think that 94% figure is in, you know, the reduction in deaths for this year?
Many of the statistics that emanate from Africa have to be kind of taken in the context that many cases are not getting diagnosed. Things may be getting misdiagnosed. There may be problems with data accumulation or data integration that can limit what you're seeing. But I think in general, seeing a decreased level of deaths is to be expected. Whether that 94% magnitude has really high statistical validity, I think remains to be seen because there are limitations. That being said, deaths are a hard outcome, meaning that they're less likely to have alterations in their death statistics than they are in cases because deaths are kind of definitive. And you can look at, for example, deaths from COVID, which then are going to be affected by diagnostic tests, but you could also look at deaths or excess deaths. How many deaths happened in this village or this town in 2022 compared to 2021 or compared to 2018 or something like that to get you some idea of what burden COVID is playing there. But oftentimes you are challenged with lack of data or lack of complete data in many countries.
And looking again at comparing statistics on the African continent, what about richer versus poorer countries in Africa in terms of their COVID deaths?
So when you look at countries like South Africa, I think they can, for the most part, be considered differently than countries in sub-Saharan Africa or countries that are with much lower per capita GDP. So there, even though we talk about Africa as a continent, there are many different levels of healthcare access, healthcare expertise, ranging from basically Western healthcare in many parts of South Africa to very poor healthcare in some of the other countries. So it's not something that can be looked at, even though people tend to think about it with one kind of, with a wave of the hand saying Africa. There's a lot of idiosyncrasies and differences amongst the way they dealt with COVID, amongst their healthcare systems, amongst access to vaccines, antivirals, healthcare capacity, all of that differs in every African country.
That's Dr. Amish Adalja, physician and infectious disease expert at the Johns Hopkins Center for Global Health, speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam via Skype today. Responding to an invitation from Vladimir Putin, Senegalese President Macky Sall is meeting tomorrow with the Russian leader about freeing up stocks of cereals and fertilizers and easing the Ukraine conflict. The French news agency AFP quoted Sall's office today as saying the shortages and skyrocketing prices resulting from the war in Ukraine are hitting African nations particularly hard. Sall is the current head of the African Union and will travel with the president of the African Union Commission. The AU will also receive a video address from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, though no date has been set. The UN said last month, Africa faces an unprecedented crisis caused by the war, compounding difficulties facing the continent from climate change to the coronavirus pandemic. Earlier this week, Sall made an appeal to European Union leaders to help ease the crisis on key commodities. He said their decision to expel Russian banks from the SWIFT financial messaging system could hurt food supplies to the continent by making payments difficult. After passing a law strengthening his grip on the judiciary, Tunisian President Kais Saied today fired 57 judges accused of corruption and other crimes. The French news agency AFP reported that Saied, who has steadily extended his powers since he sacked the government and suspended parliament last July, issued a decree late yesterday allowing him to fire judges for actions that could compromise the judiciary's reputation, independence, or functioning. The official Gazette today published a list of judges who have been dismissed and may face prosecution. It did not list reasons for their dismissals. Tunisia's International Commission of Jurists regional director Said Benarabai said, Said now has powers to sack judges by decreeing and without process. He called the move an affront to the separation of powers and judicial independence. The president insists he has no intention of interfering with the judiciary. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Please note, we have moved our programs from voanews.com to voaafrica.com. There, you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com. Tensions remain high between the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda following a series of deadly militia attacks in the eastern DRC. Yesterday, the DRC Foreign Minister, Christophe Lutundula, met with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Washington. Speaking before their meeting, Blinken told Lutundula the United States backs efforts on the continent to restore calm.
We are very glad to be working with the DRC to advance our privileged partnership for peace, prosperity, and preservation of the environment. So we have a lot of work that we've been doing and we'll continue to do on that. I'm very much also looking forward to discussing how we can support peace and security and stability in the eastern DRC, which is under some challenge, but where we want to be very supportive of important African efforts that are ongoing to deal with those challenges. And I must say, particularly, we applaud the diplomatic efforts that we see underway for the Nairobi Initiative and the pursuit of a lasting peace in the region, something the United States very much supports.
The Nairobi Initiative is a series of talks among the DRC government and some of the different rebel groups fighting in the country's east. The first round of talks arranged by the Kenyan government with the backing of the East African Community were in April. However, one militia known as the M23 has said the government did not meet its demands and resumed fighting last month. Many in the DRC accused the Rwanda government of backing the M23, which Rwanda denies. Kigali accuses the Kinshasa government of backing another rebel group that kidnapped two Rwandan soldiers. Over the past few weeks, the two governments have exchanged harsh words. The DRC barred Rwanda Air from flying into the country, and Rwanda has said it will respond to any attacks on its territory. DRC Foreign Minister Lutundula noted that the United States has been a friend to the country since independence in 1960. He says he and President Felix Tshisekedi appreciate U.S. support.
Nous traversons une période assez difficile et tous les efforts au niveau diplomatique, efforts au niveau aussi des contributions financières dans les organisations du système des Nations Unies qui opèrent en RDC, on sait qu'en fait...
He says the DRC is going through difficult times at the moment and appreciates diplomatic, economic, and humanitarian contributions coming through the United Nations system. He says the U.S. is the largest contributor for MONUSCO, the UN peacekeeping force. Lutundula also says it shows the hope the U.S. has in the possibility that the DRC will play a role in Africa to consolidate democracy, the rule of law, and to become an ally that will take part in building those values that our peoples and our countries are fighting for. The African Union and other groups are trying to bring the presidents of the DRC and Rwanda together for talks to de-escalate the situation. With concerns about the situation expanding, I asked Jean-Pierre Carigier, doctor of philosophy at Dixon College in Pennsylvania, how the escalating tension between the two countries can be diffused.
Of course, there was a conflict that has been, the way people are portraying it is just a conflict between Rwanda and the Congo. But I think there are several factors in this conflict. And of course, with the setting with the M23. But when we look at a conflict like Rwanda and Democratic Republic of the Congo, I think the very beginning in terms of the two states is 1994 after the genocide, when FDLR, those who committed the genocide in Rwanda, went to the Congo and they continued to attack Rwanda from the Congo. So that was in 1994, and they are still very active. So it means really for Rwanda is the issue of security. That is one. And the second, then you have, of course, the emergency of M23. Right now.
Do you see any solution to the DRC and Rwanda problem now?
First of all, I think one of the solutions for me is not to reduce the crisis in terms of Rwanda and the Congo, because this can be also used as a pretext for the Congo to deal with real social issues that's had in the country. I just mentioned right now the insecurity, food, for example, in the region where the president is coming from. So, and I think, yes, we need to have, like, for example, the two countries to continue dialogue, and I think they're still having dialogue. The president of Angola, I read, like, the president of Angola is continuing to have discussion with the two presidents from Rwanda and Congo. That should be very, very important. So, and I think it means the channels are still open. There's a possibility of a peace, and everyone is with that. But I think also to avoid the conflict is to avoid somehow to involve population like in hate speech. So we have that is going on in the Congo. That is very dangerous when you involve the population and that. So and also to deal with real issues of the country. And I think Congo needs to have the role of government approach to different issues. That will be very, very helpful. So and also to make sure that Rwanda and the Congo, they are not involved, for example, in backing like rebel groups. That should be one of the situations. But I really think like Congo needs also to have this safe and a stable environment, and especially for the population. And I believe they have like a social and economical issues that need to be addressed.
That was Jean-Pierre Carrigier, Doctor of Philosophy at Dixon College. He was talking to me from Pennsylvania. Central African Republic refugees in Cameroon have started returning home after fleeing political and sectarian violence there since 2014. There are around 300,000 car refugees in Cameroon, most of them women and children. Hundreds have agreed to return home after Bangui promised peace has returned to their towns and villages. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Gado Badezere on Cameroon's border with car.
Cameroonian officials handed out food and blankets at a camp in Gado Badjeri Wednesday to about 300 Central African refugees who agreed to return home. Gado Badjeri hosts more than 30,000 CAR refugees out of 300,000 who fled conflict. 35-year-old farmer Robert Bisa is one of the refugees who is returning this week to the Central African Republic. He left the CAR in 2017 after a rebel attack on a military base killed civilians and destroyed the shop where he sold his produce. Bisa says he received assurances from his family back home that peace has returned to his village in the south of the CAR. He says he intends to go back to his farm and grow beans and groundnuts. Cameroon authorities and the UN's refugee agency, the UNHCR, say 2,500 refugees, most of them women and children, have agreed to return home before the end of this year. But UNHCR Cameroon representative Olivier Bier says most of the refugees in Cameroon are still reluctant.
Nous ne sommes pas encore dans une situation de rapatriement promu.
Bier says a majority of the refugees have not accepted to voluntarily return because security is unstable in the CAR. But he says there are some towns and villages that have been pacified by the CAR's military. A CAR official receiving the refugees on the border said they would be socially and economically reintegrated and that their safety and security would be assured. Cameroon's Territorial Administration Minister Paul Atanganji says militaries on both sides will protect refugees as they were returning home. Nji says there are still problems of CAR rebels crossing into Cameroon to steal supplies and abduct civilians for ransom.
It is important to reiterate the instructions of President Paul Biya that the departure must be voluntary and the convoy must have all the necessary security measures. We have asked the security forces in Cameroon to accompany the convoy. And by the time we get to the boundaries, the security forces from the neighboring country will continue with the convoy.
Violence erupted among armed groups in the CAR in 2013 when the then president, François Bozize, was ousted by the Seleka, a Muslim minority rebel coalition. In January 2021, hundreds of CAR civilians fled sporadic clashes after the presidential election, many of them to Cameroon. The UN says since 2013, close to 1 million Central Africans have fled conflict to neighboring Cameroon, Chad, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Nigeria. The voluntary repatriation of CAR refugees began in 2016 but was suspended in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Gado Bajere, Cameroon.
The government of Zimbabwe has ordered farmers to submit their maize to the Grain Marketing Board to help make up for shortfalls being submitted to the country's central maize buying agency. More on the story from Bulawayo.
The permanent secretary for the Ministry of Agriculture, John Basera, made the announcement over the weekend in a bid to prevent shortages due to failed rains and crop failures this farming season. The ministry says farmers only submitted 5,000 metric tons instead of the 30,000 metric tons that was expected to the Grain Marketing Board, or GMB, and fears abound about possible side marketing of maize by farmers and dealers. Observers say the problem may also be driven by grievances over the official purchase price of maize, which pays farmers 30% of their money in US dollars and the rest in local currency. Growers say the regulation compromises their viability due to the hyperinflation and the cost of inputs priced in U.S. currency. VOA reached out to farmers to get their side of the story. Winston Babbage is the vice president of commodities at the Zimbabwe Commercial Farmers Union. He says some farmers may be withholding maize to feed their livestock.
This we welcome because you've got nothing to hide. As farmers, got nothing to hide. Who knew that you got to apply to GMB to retain your income?
On the subject of farmer irritation over payments in local currency, Babbage says the government needs to level the playing field given the fact that input suppliers charge goods in US dollars.
That's not right. We're in hyperinflation. Yeah. The parallel market rate is now sitting at, in some places, 500.
The US dollar is trading at between 400 and 500 Zimbabwean dollars on the unofficial market for foreign currencies. Last week, the Grain Millers Association of Zimbabwe announced that the country will need to import 400,000 metric tons at the cost of US $100 million. Dealers or middlemen source grain from neighboring countries for the Grain Millers Association. Babbage says the foreign exchange government avails to them is misdirected.
Why can't you give the farmer that US dollar? Or upfront the farmer to crop for you? That money, if it was available, should have been given as an outgrowth scheme to all the farmers. What you reap what you sow.
Observers and stakeholders such as Babbage say farmers must be properly supported with funds for tillage, seed, agrochemicals, and fertilizers.
We're meeting the minister on Wednesday, I think. We're going to discuss with him. I'm going to tell them our grievances. Let's capacitate the farmer. That's the bottom line. Farmers are sitting idle because there's no capacity for the farmer.
Observers and economic analysts agree with Babbage that greater support for farmers would curb the risk of food shortages. For VOA in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.